It is Saturday, September 26th, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Primsch, and with me in the studio is Lyle Troxell, software engineer, maker, and family man. Hey, Lyle.
Hello, hello.
Also, right next to him is Ben Jaffe, a teacher, traveler, and music geek.
Hi.
Hey, Ben. Yep, it's a big show today. We're going to talk about all kinds of things. We're going to start with Bitcoin, a popular subject here at GeekSpeak, and it's had a pleasant development.
Well, the virtual money, the famous one, Bitcoin, which we've talked about for years on GeekSpeak, it's all about encryption and making it completely public but also private. It's really kind of a fascinating process when you can listen to old shows and on. But what's the story that we've talked about probably the most about Bitcoin? Bonnie, what do you think?
Its legitimacy as a currency.
Yeah, whether it is a currency or not. Mm-hmm. And that of course, comes down to whether you believe it's a currency and whether you use it as a currency.
Right.
The other story we cover, and the one I think about the most, is the volatility of Bitcoin. So sometimes it's worth a lot, sometimes it's worth less. And it's always been kind of impressive how much it's worth. It's based on the work it takes for a computer to generate random numbers and actually to calculate out. Well, we won't get into the math more, but the point is that it's been very volatile. And a lot of companies actually take advantage of that by selling kind of a futures on Bitcoin.
So you can
actually,
they're doing that now?
Yeah, they
are. I didn't know that. I didn't realize.
And the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC, announced on Thursday it filed to settle charges against a Bitcoin exchange for facilitating the trade of option contracts on its own platform. So some website that was selling futures, basically, of Bitcoin was taken to court, and they settled out of court by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
Okay.
And basically, in this press release by the CFTC, they said this is the first time finds that Bitcoin and other virtual currencies are properly defined as a commodity. Not a currency, but a commodity.
Oh, a commodity.
So just like you would sell, I don't know, pork bellies.
Okay.
And you'd sell futures in pork bellies and stuff. Uh-huh, uh-huh. You can do that with Bitcoin. And therefore, all the rules and regulations, the traditional rules and regulations about selling commodities and trading commodities, take effect, which means any company that wants to actually participate in selling and trading Bitcoins legally will have to participate by the rules of any commodity.
Hmm. So if we were to speak metaphorically about this story and compare it to, say, the Pluto story.
How?
Well, like Pluto was a planet, but then it wasn't a planet,
well,
but now it's a planet. We thought it was a planet, but actually it's this other thing. It sounds like Bitcoin, it might be the reverse. We thought it was one thing, which is pretty cool, but in fact it's this other thing which could actually wield a lot more power, couldn't it, as a commodity rather than just a straight-up currency?
I think that commodity gives it a very clear definition of legality, which is useful.
Yeah.
At the same time, I think because of its basis off of what it's potentially worth, not actually in ability to like eat bacon or something of that nature, like other commodities, it seems much more like a currency to me. But the idea of assigning it as a commodity allows us to regulate it very clearly and fall into a normal traditional pattern.
Okay, but you feel the same way, Ben? You've been kind of the closest follower, I'll say, of the Bitcoin story.
Well, I mean, I was just thinking as you guys were talking that really money is ultimately a proxy for items, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we used to do a lot of bartering, and then
used to be salt.
Right, or I have one ox, like this is Oregon Trail or something, right? But money is really a proxy for items. And so, Bitcoin being a currency makes a lot of sense, but really having it be treated as a commodity to me just primarily legitimizes it legally.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really change what it is to me or how I might use it. It's still a proxy for something. It's still a proxy for something I could go out and buy.
So would you be then excited to hear that it's gotten a degree of legitimacy regardless of whether it's currency or commodity?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, any legitimacy that is given to a currency like Bitcoin, I think, is a win, ultimately.
Well, and where do you think we're going to go from here with Bitcoin then, if it's a commodity now?
I think it's going to keep on operating very similar to the way it's operated. I think that's interesting is that it's been kind of a free-for-all in a lot of ways,
right,
because there's not really been a clear definition of what it is, whether you taxed on it, the whole different rules that take place. But it clearly, well, so Aiton Goldman, the CFTC's director of enforcement, in a statement said, while there is a lot of excitement surrounding Bitcoin and other virtual currencies, innovation does not excuse those acting in this space from following the same rules applicable to participants in the commodity derivatives market. So he's basically saying it's fun, it's interesting, it's changing dynamically, but we can regulate it regularly.
Yeah.
And okay. I think it probably makes sense.
So that's why he's excited.
Yeah, and I think a large part of this, it does add legitimacy. I think I agree with Ben completely.
Yeah, legitimacy, but also an ability to be contained and managed in some way.
Also, speaking of Pluto, Pluto is so much more awesome than we thought it was. Like, for ages and ages on this program, I've been like, oh yeah, then there's Pluto. It's just a hunk of rock.
Oh, but we saw some photos recently.
We fly by it, and it's got likely volcanic activity. It's got all kinds of crazy stuff. Yeah. And, like, it is so not just some lame rock. It's...
So whether or not it's called a planet, it's awesome.
Right, yeah. And really, it being called a planet or not called a planet, it doesn't have all that much to do with it itself. It just has to do with what we as ugly bags of water, i.e. humans, decide we're going to call it, you know?
All right. Well, thanks for helping me make that metaphor work.
Right.
All right. So you also heard some news recently about AVG. This is a security company. I know about them because I had a friend years and years ago install free AVG security software.
Yeah, it's an antivirus software, right?
Antivirus, right.
Yeah, exactly. And so the goal is, you know, install some antivirus software and then it scans things as they go through your computer. And if it finds any viruses, then it catches those viruses.
A little history on GeekSpeak. We used to make AVG our recommended install for antivirus software on Windows machines. So it used to be that we'd have recommendations regularly on this program, and we'd say, you know, you got to install this, whatever. And AVG was one of these ones that it was free, it worked really well, it had a good library, it was easy to install, and so we recommended it all the time on the program. We've since stopped recommending AVG for other sources. But
oh, so is it not having as fun a trajectory as Bitcoin is having?
If we could compare them one-to-one, perhaps. But it's Bitcoin is definitely more exciting because there's more happening in that space. But the news that I have is kind of a little bit sad and a little bit confusing and bewildering. And it's simply that AVG recently changed their privacy policy. And they've got some very strange things in that privacy policy. So I'm just going to read a chunk of it. They say in the new privacy policy, quote, "We collect non-personal data to make money from our free offerings so we can keep them free."
Okay, that sounds familiar.
So far, that's fine. Yeah, it makes sense. Continuing, including advertising ID associated with your device. Okay, I'm not so happy about that because they're collecting a unique identifier for me as opposed to you or as opposed to Lyle.
Yeah, that sounds a little more personal.
Continuing on, they say browsing and search history, including metadata.
Wait a minute.
Whoa.
Metadata is the whole problem with the NSA kerfuffle.
Browsing and search history, that's definitely not non-personal data.
That's some sort of micro, fine, very personal data.
Right. Like, I search for my home address all the time to pull up Google Maps, right?
To find out how you get home.
to find out, where do I live again? But I mean, it's nice, you know? So I pull it up and I see how to navigate from somewhere else to my home.
Right.
That is my search history. That's in my search history.
Okay.
And it's not even simple. It's not even things that are that clear. There are all kinds of interesting patterns that you can pull out of any amount of massive amount of data.
We've all had the sad misfortune to learn quite a bit about metadata recently. Yes.
Yeah. And here's the rest of it. They also are collecting, including internet service provider or mobile network you use to connect to our products, so your ISP, and information regarding other applications you may have used on your device and how they are used. That is incredibly broad.
How do any of those following sentences have anything to do with the first one?
You mean what their business is?
We collect non-personal data?
Right. None of that sounds non-personal to me.
It doesn't sound non-personal
exactly
at all.
None of it.
So that is extraordinarily confusing. They also add in another place that personal identify information like addresses, age, or IP, even if not sold, may sometimes be shared with collaborators.
Whoa.
What does that mean?
Why?
And then they also mention that And I'm just reading this from the article, not from the privacy policy directly, but it says, okay. AVG has mentioned that it will not sell personal data like name. Okay, all of that is personal data, but they won't sell data like name, email, addresses, or credit card details, but that these might sometimes leak inside the browsing history. Well, that's kind of a problem. And then they say,
we'll take
precautionary measures to filter out personal details. But we all know, if you listen to GeekSpeak much, you know how we talk about it. It's really hard to anonymize data, even if you're doing everything as right as you can, even if you work for someone like Facebook and that's what they pay you for. It is so, so hard to do that on a large scale. And that's what they're saying that they'll do.
Well, and it's AVG. This is a company that you think...
Antivirus, right? That's what it's for, antivirus. Right. And they're there because it's so difficult to get your machine safe, right? So you need a protector. So in a lot of ways, they feel like this marshal of justice on the internet, right? Mm-hmm. And yet they're doing this. So it feels like a betrayal. And just to say more about the search history thing, the reason why it's so difficult to actually remove private information is that, you know, even if you pull out people's names, you're still going to have names in there, right? Because you can't know if a word is a name or not, right? My daughter's name is River, for example, right? Mm-hmm, but additionally, there's names of stores near your home that have a unique name. And if you search for that name, even just that name, that of the, you know, there's a grocery store or something by a special name, searching that kind of means you live there, right? Because why else would you be searching that? So there is so much information that you can anonymize it, and it is completely personal. Now, what they're referencing is the identifiable information, and that has to do with regulations around credit card information, what information is identifiable, and there's rules around that. So they're basically saying those things will remove. But as you said, search history, you probably can recover that information, unfortunately.
So when I first heard about this story, I thought, well, clearly they're scrambling for dollars.
Yeah, so
like,
I mean,
things have gotten bad at AVG, now they're selling stuff for money.
Right. So I mean, there are a couple of ways that you can interpret this. And my first interpretation was, whoa, this is totally wrong. They've lost their marbles, and this is totally creepy, because honestly, who reads the privacy policy, right? Mm-hmm, there are going to be a lot of people who are not informed about what they're agreeing to, agreeing to that privacy policy, because AVG has a good name. A lot of people recommend it. You know, like we recommended it on our previous podcast. If someone goes back and listens, they'll hear us recommending AVG.
We no longer recommend it officially.
For many other reasons, but now for this reason. But my second interpretation was these people write very complex software to detect and remove viruses. Clearly, they know better. They have to know better.
Right.
They're exactly the kinds of people who would know that you can't just pull out identifying information in a huge data set. And so that led me think a little more critically about this. Like, what's really going on here? It's probably not the people who are making the software making this choice. You know, like, it's got to be. It's got to not be.
So you're talking about sort of like a disjointed company where on the one hand, you got your techies who are building the product, and on the other hand, are the people making really poor business decisions?
That's one interpretation. That's one possibility. Like, the fact is, I have no idea what's going on.
We don't really know.
But I'm thinking, like, it just seems so improbable that the people who are writing this software, who are the ones who are making this choice, right? So it makes me wonder, like, do they have some lawyer friend or some business friend, and they're like, hey, you know, can you write us a new privacy? I don't know. Like,
well, I think Bonnie's assumption is that they're probably trying to make money, right? And they're probably not doing well. That's a pressure.
That also makes sense.
I think you're giving too much optimism for what software engineers will do. I think that people are people, and there's some people that would like to be able to, you know, pay their rent and make money. And I don't know if it's a bad decision, a business decision, because I don't know how many people actually know that this is going on, as you said.
Right.
You know, luckily the GeekSpeak listeners know that AVG is doing something a little devious, and you should probably get away from them. But not everybody will.
Maybe this is
a thing where mission creep leads to a very creepy mission.
Mission creep. Nice.
You know? But also, I mean, it's possible that there was like the core, like, yeah, we're going to build this thing, right?
Yeah.
Those guys built it. Family, and I'm going to do something else now. And
yeah, they moved on.
There might be some like turnover in the techie side that's less dedicated to the purpose behind the original thing.
That is a good possibility. That is another possibility. I mean,
because that happens in other organizations also.
Right. So like I have a Chrome extension that I've built, and I've got 12,000 users. And so conceivably, if I wasn't an engineer in Silicon Valley and I wasn't doing so well, or I wanted to somehow find a way to monetize that, it's very, very easy to take that simple, totally justified thought, and just like 1 inch at a time, inch towards some place that's clearly over the line. But you don't notice yourself doing it if you make a choice like that, you know? So I don't know. So maybe I'm just being too optimistic. Maybe it's just that they've decided to go crazy. But it's just, it's weird. It's beyond how awkward and not okay the new privacy policy is. Mm-hmm. The entire story is so much weirder than the privacy policy is bad in my mind. Like, I just don't really understand it.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk more about what can happen once a company's been around for a while. When we get back, this is Geek Speak here on KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me is Ben Jaffe and Lyle Troxell. By the way, you can visit our website, geekspeak.org, to learn more about what we've been talking about every week, really. You can go there and see what we've been talking about. You can also go there to see things that we call web extras these days. These are things that must be seen. And Lyle, what is this thing, this week's thing that must be seen?
This week is a YouTube video of drones, you know, those little toys.
No, basically. We knew about the drones, yeah.
Not the military ones, but these are the quadcopters.
Wee.
Quadcopters flying around. Okay. And what they're doing, and this is in Zurich Flying Machine Arena. It's basically a small space where you can fly drones.
That sounds
They've
fun.
Got two scaffoldings. Uh-huh. They have three of these quadcopter drones, okay, with spools of, I think, paracord, which is a 500-pound test cord.
What are they weaving?
They are weaving a rope bridge. So they fly around these things and actually release their cabling, and then they wrap it up, and then they fly across a chasm probably of 15 to 20 feet, uh-huh, and they go to the next side. And slowly over together, all three of them working in unison, they create a rope bridge with handles. And at the very end of the video, you can see it being used.
Cool.
So pretty cool. The idea being, of course, that you could have like a suitcase and some rope and come to a chasm and then send the drones to build the bridge for you. And it slowly goes back and forth and you walk across.
That so fits.
Hopefully get them to.
It is incredible to watch this.
Well, yeah. I can't wait to see it.
It's like a three and a half minute video. And it's just so cool to see.
It's mesmerizing.
Wait, guys,
well, Bonnie,
you
can see it up at geekspeak.org.
I'm going to go do that after the show. Yeah.
Also, people walk across this bridge.
So
they build
like
this bridge, and then
bridge.
The researchers walk across the bridge. It's amazing.
And so how do you think you design something like that? Do you have to program the choreography?
I think it's all very programmed, actually. So it's probably just a test thing because they're doing pretty impressive things. Though, it might be that they just have software that's written for them to do this. I didn't read the full article. I just watched the YouTube video because it's more fun that way. But what I did notice is that there was a collision. One of them during this video actually hit one of their props on the scaffolding.
Oops.
And recovered fine.
Yeah.
And then went back to where it was before. Excuse me. I shouldn't
have
a personality.
Where he was?
Where it was before. It is a machine.
Listen, this is how easily
it
happens.
Yeah, it does.
I for one welcome. Right. I don't even need to finish that sentence. All right. Well, so this is the part of the show on Geek Speak where we can get into a little beefier discussion about topics of the day or things that are sort of undergirding structures for all of geekery.
Undergirding?
Undergirding.
I've never heard of that word.
I never want to hear it again.
It's used in bridges.
Is it?
Nicely done.
And so this week we want to talk about software.
Yeah, software complexity. And actually what brings us to this topic is two stories, one of which we I remember seeing this particular story. This was maybe a year ago or something like that? It was like 3 or 4 months ago. And I remember seeing the story and thinking, this is a really interesting story. We should cover it on GeekSpeak. And I think I chose to not cover it because
what?
It's a security.
What is the story?
It's a security story.
Okay.
And it was a vulnerability in Skype that was actually, it was in the wild. Everybody who used Skype had this vulnerability. They patched it up. And
Skype is like that free telecommunication software, right? You
yeah.
can do voice and video
it's
conferencing.
It's like video chat, audio
it's,
chat.
It's FaceTime for the others, isn't it?
It's FaceTime before FaceTime.
An actual thing.
The bug was if I type to you, so I can chat with you through Skype. It could be like, hey, Bonnie, you coming to the show. Mm-hmm. If I type to you the following, http://:// and then I send it to you, it crashes your client.
Hey.
It doesn't just crash it like you have to reopen it. It crashes it where you actually have to install an older version.
What? That's a big crash.
That's a, it's a really, it was a really bad bug. And like, how do things like that happen? You know, like, so as
it seems pretty random, like weirdly specific.
As programmers, you know, Lyle and I could probably BS a little bit and come up with some relatively simple.
Well, you know, what I find fascinating about this, Ben, is we covered a story years ago on Geekspeak. After Microsoft had bought Skype, what some researchers noticed is if they put in a URL that had never been out in the wild before, a URL like what you type into a browser, and you'd never seen it before. A little bit after that, you'd see a server from Seattle hit it with a checking the basically address. When Microsoft was asked about this, they said, well, we've got to make sure that we're protecting the people by passing viruses around or not. So if I send you a URL and on that URL there's a virus, mm-hmm. or, you know, it's an infected site, and then you click on it, potentially that could be dangerous for you. Mm-hmm. So they were kind of pre-caching and filtering, which means they were inspecting the actual data of the Skype communication. Not very cool. What's interesting is this bug is exactly the reason, that's the reason it's happening.
Yeah, exactly.
So what happens is you give a URL that's actually invalid, and the software goes, oh, let me check out that URL. And it goes, and it just dies.
I cannot do
it. It's like giving instructions to, you know, jump out the window. And you're like, okay. Yeah. So it's interesting that if that happened, you would expect software engineers to catch that kind of simple problem.
Yeah, but here's the problem. That problem that seems simple when you're looking at that problem, you're like, okay, well, that's a simple problem. That's mm-hmm. just 8 characters and it'll crash Skype. Catching all of the potential error cases and handling them all properly is so much of a software engineer's job, both thinking about all of this stuff and also writing the code to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So for example, like, actually, here's the other story, which this is a story from just a couple days ago.
It's like another example.
Yes.
Okay.
Currently, with Chrome 45, and I'm covering this story because it's not a vulnerability that you can really compromise someone with or anything like that, because it's not cool to crash someone's Skype when they need to talk to their friend.
Hey, kids, don't crash your friend's stuff.
Right. You can crash your own Chrome if you want to. I don't want to. I've got a lot of tabs open.
Yeah.
I'd lose all that stuff. But it's 16 characters. You can type http://, which is the beginning of a URL, and you type this in the location bar. http://a/%%30%30
Now, who does that just for randoms? That's so specific.
So it's very, very likely that this is one example of many different combinations of this URL that would crash Chrome.
Oh, okay.
Right. So this is just what someone happened to accidentally
find. I see. It's a class of thing that would crash
exactly,
it.
Exactly. Oh. So probably %31%31 would work too, because, well, %30 is the UTF encoding for the character 0.
Okay.
And so 31 is the character 1. It's probably not relevant.
I'm happy to assume that's the case without testing it out myself.
Right. So let's not do that.
Okay.
But the whole point is that software is ridiculously, ridiculously complex.
Yeah. Well, and this is why we always have all these vulnerability issues, right?
Yeah,
memory
right,
leak vulnerabilities,
exactly.
People taking advantage. And we always have to say, you know, patch your machine, patch your machine, patch your machine. Because as we find these things in the wild, we have to fix them. And the question always is, well, why don't we just not have these problems in the first place? And that is the trick, right? And you, well, Ben and I are software engineers, and so we kind of know this from, like, we've both written bugs.
Yeah, no, and my mom was a coder from way back, you know,
yes.
And she took great pride in being able to, like, well, I'm just going to, like, think of the design. What's the function of what I'm trying to write here? And then how would it work out just in kind of plain English? What's the outline for how it's supposed to function? And I'll just code that. And, you know, she said that it took care of 99.9999% of bugs.
Agreed. In fact, it does gets rid of 99.999% of bugs. The problem is that other percentage, a little bit.
Right. So both of these are examples of getting input from users mm-hmm. and then handling it improperly. Right. So if you're coding and you know you have an array of some stuff and then you want to go over that array in this particular way, you're probably not very likely to come across bugs because the space in which you're operating is very understood
mm-hmm.
and the type of input that you get in is expected and you can test against anything else.
You're exhibiting expected behavior by interacting normally with the
Right. But stuff. Doing something like parsing a URL mm-hmm. is actually ridiculously crazy, crazy complicated. Mm-hmm. Same thing with, say, validating an email address. If you look up the specification of what an email address technically is and what's allowed and what's not allowed, it is so, so complicated.
Okay.
So imagine writing a piece of software that handles all of these cases in this document that some standards group decided on.
Well, and if I think about, you know, the enormously complex software just to make sort of one thing happen, like Chrome.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's one sort of like a system, right? And then that system interacts with websites.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's got its own set of code. I mean, everything's sort of interacting with each other. And to account for that must be also enormously complicated.
Yeah. So this brings me to a particular Google Plus post that Jean-Baptiste Carreau, also known as JBQ, mm-hmm. for exactly the reason I just botched his pronunciation yes. of his name.
Bless his initials.
So he posted this really fantastic post. It's called Dizzying but Invisible Depth. Mm-hmm. And we're linking to it on geekspeak.org. But let me just read, kind of paraphrase what it says. Okay. It says, you just went to the Google homepage. Simple, isn't it? What just actually happened? And then he goes on and he says, like, okay, well, there's HTTP, HTML, CSS, blah, 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 blah. These are actually such incredibly complex technologies that they'll make any engineer dizzy if they think about it too much, and that no single company can deal with that entire complexity. Let's simplify. So he takes a step back and he says, you just connected your computer to Google.com. And then he goes through this whole thing.
Well, and that also is
that last
complex.
Sentence is exactly identical. They make any engineer dizzy if they think about it too much. Let's simplify. You just typed Google.com in the location bar of your browser. Like you didn't
that's,
even press
that's
enter.
All you've done,
that's
right?
All you've done.
All you've done, yeah.
Simple, isn't it? Well, what actually happened? And he goes into how operating, so you just put into play a kernel, a USB host stack, an input dispatcher, an event handler, a font handler, a subpixel rasterizer, etc.
Oh,
right?
Gosh, yeah.
He just like really goes into it.
Yeah.
And he says, blah, 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 blah. Let's simplify. You just pressed a key on your keyboard. Simple, isn't it? What just actually happened? Well, when you know a bit about how input peripherals work, it's not quite simple. You just put into play, and he goes on and lists these
wow.
crazy things. And then he says, can we simplify further? In fact, very scarily, no, we can't. We can barely comprehend the complexity of a single chip in a computer keyboard, and yet there's no simpler level. The next step takes us to the software that is used to design the chip's logic, and that software itself has a level of complexity that requires to go back to the top of the loop.
Okay, wait a second. What you're saying is, in your keyboard of the computer, the keyboard
yes.
itself, like if you unplugged it from your computer, if you had an external keyboard, the keyboard itself has a chip on there, and that chip is more complicated than the human mind can really grasp.
Yes.
I'm really happy for my typewriter collection.
That's just pressing the letter
that's right,
the
Bonnie,
letter A.
Bonnie, typewriter, you can actually understand it because
yeah.
there's like a little lever.
No, wait, hold on a second. I got a typewriter from a yard sale,
yeah.
this German typewriter, and that thing is so complicated.
Yeah,
it's just all mechanical. So you can see all the pieces moving and you could be like, how the heck does this work? And if you really stare at it long enough and really study it, then you can kind of comprehend it for a second.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, the machinery of that typewriter, from the base level, the levers and all that, is a mechanical experience that our bodies understand and feel.
Right,
right?
Yeah.
Because we
yeah.
can actually understand that. We can
I
get
push
on
push something, it goes clack.
Right. So we really mm-hmm. get that. When
we
actually talk
it.
About logic
yeah.
gates and how transistors work, you have to get into quantum theory. And pretty quickly, it goes outside the realm of what you can actually understand. So, and that's the other thing about that chip. You know, the chip is made up of all these transistors, and the reason why we can't really comprehend it is the mass scale. You mm-hmm. actually have to have a computer to manage the chip, and so you have that loop problem. But that chip itself, when you actually go back to the transistor, just the transistor, then we have to have metaphors because we don't actually understand what's happening in a transistor.
Well, it's a good thing we think in metaphors anyway.
That's true.
So there is more, and I promise you this will all be worthwhile. Here's the next paragraph, and I love this. For non-technologists, this is all a black box, which means you don't understand any of it. You just know you do stuff, and some stuff comes back.
Yeah.
That is a great success of technology. All those layers of complexity are entirely hidden, and people can use them without even knowing that they exist at all. That's the reason why so many people can, is why so many people find computers so frustrating to use. There's so many things that can possibly go wrong that some of them inevitably will, but the complexity goes so deep that it's impossible for most users to be able to do anything about any error. That's also why it's so hard for technologists and non-technologists to communicate together. And actually, I would even...
what a noble effort this show is.
right. That brings us to why we're here. And I would actually go so far as to say that's why it's difficult for even technologists to communicate. Yeah. If you talk to someone who works on low-level hardware, and you know they're talking to you, Lyle, or me, who work on primarily web technologies, those worlds are very different. We've got algorithms in common. We've got some math in common. We've got some verbs in our programming languages in common. But it's really quite a different world.
Okay. But let me just play devil's advocate in fact, how I actually feel. So I learned electronics when I was young. You know, in middle school, I dropped out of school and started learning electronics. Mm-hmm. And at that time, all this seemed amazing to me. But those base fundamentals actually do translate all the way up, right? And I did, when I was in college, build logic gates. I know how to do that, right? I can do assembly. Not that I like do that all the time, but having that breadth of knowledge, I don't feel like any of this is that mysterious. Mm-hmm. But mystery and complexity are not the same thing, right? Mm. The complexity I comprehend at a level that, you know, boggles my mind, right? The amount of complexity is there. But when it comes down to how it actually works, it's not mysterious to me. It's knowable. It's just large.
That's a really beautiful way to put it. And so kind of applying what you just said to what I was just saying, there is a large chasm between technologists in different departments and different mm-hmm. areas, mm-hmm. right? But we're all kind of in the same area, right? So there may be a huge gap between where you're sitting, Lyle, and where I'm sitting based on what we know, but we have that common vocabulary in common, right? Somebody who doesn't know how to program, or somebody who... hi, Vani.
Hi, no, how's it going?
But somebody who doesn't know how to program or hasn't really had any experience with any part of that, there's a much larger chasm. There's that mystery chasm. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you dive in and learn to program a little bit, at least your foot's in the door, right? And so there may still be a large chasm, but at least you kind of understand a little bit in the space.
I spent a lot of time at the University of Santa Cruz, California, there, we tried to teach programming to artists. And I saw a lot of professors try to do this, right? Computer engineering professors do it over the years. And what I found was a very common practice was to talk about how the actual transistor work, how the logic gates work, like get to the very low level and start building its way up. Because a lot of them, that's how they learned. But the truth is that the complexity level of a programming language like JavaScript or Java or Objective-C or something, that language allows you to communicate at a level that's so much more complex and rich and wonderful than the low-level understanding language.
Yeah.
I don't think you have to understand how transistors work at any level to be an amazingly good programmer, right? Just like you don't really need to know how a piano is manufactured to be an amazing pianist. Mm-hmm. You happen to know a little bit about it if you do that field, but they are separate. There's levels of complexity that stack on top of each other that is fine to be at to understand. I mean, just like it, you know, a person using a computer does not need to know how to program it to effectively use it.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. Now, I've got one more paragraph for you guys. And
okay.
I recommend...
This is from JBQ.
Yeah. I do recommend that everybody go and read this entire thing because it's really interesting, especially if you're at all technically minded. It really is mind-boggling how many things we take for granted that we code on top of, right? But one of his paragraphs, he talks about how, you know, when Steve Jobs died and Dennis Ritchie died, who got more people talking about them?
Whose name we recognize.
Right. We recognize his name because he does stuff that we as a populace recognize.
Mm.
Whereas the people who are more ingrained in the field, even if they had a larger impact on the field, which is, you know,
more
debatable,
fundamental
I would
impact.
Say so.
Yeah.
It's not something that you can really, it's hard to compare them because one of them is within this world and one of them is visible to the outside. And here's that last paragraph. Finally, last but not least, this is why our patent system is broken. Technology has done such an amazing job of hiding its complexity that the people regulating and running the patent system are barely aware of any of the complexity of what they're running and regulating. That's the ultimate bike shedding. Just that, like the proverbial discussion in the town hall about a nuclear power plant end up being about the paint color for the plant's bike shed, the patent discussions about modern computing technologies end up being about screen sizes and icon ordering, because in both cases, these are the only aspect that people involved in the discussion are capable of discussing. even though they are irrelevant to the actual function of the overall system being discussed.
That may have implications for a story we're going to cover in the next section here on Geek Speak. You are listening, by the way, to Geek Speak here on KUSP with me, Bonnie Jean. That was Ben Jaffe, also Lyle Troxell, and we'll be right back. It's Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Bonnie Primsch, and I'm speaking with Lyle Troxell and Ben Jaffe. And we were getting into some big stuff. Let's get back to sort of a moment-by-moment situation. Android's new OS.
Android Lollipop has a password problem. Now, this is a problem which allows someone to pick up your phone and get past your password, if you have a password. Some people have a little unlock thing.
That's a big problem.
It's a big problem, yeah.
It turns out all you have to do is have a boyfriend who watches your keystrokes when you're typing in your password.
Or a 13-year-old son.
Yeah. Whoops.
So, you know, keep your phone in your pocket or change it from a password to something else, a pass key or a one of the little click to drag along the dots thing. So there are multiple methods of authentication. But here's the problem is the way you do it is you open up the phone's emergency call feature. I'm sorry. Never mind. This totally applies to everybody. And there is a fix along the way just to address that question before
what?
It comes up.
What are we talking about?
You open up the phone's emergency call feature, you type a couple characters, and then you copy and paste the text over and over and over again. So you've got like 4 characters, then you copy and paste it, now you have 8, then you copy and paste all of it, you have 16, and then 32. So you're basically filling up this text field to be really, 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 really full. And once you get somewhere around 150, 200 to 200,000 total characters, something happens. Maybe there's a buffer overflow or something inside the software, and it pops onto the lock onto the home screen.
It unlocks the phone.
It unlocks the phone.
So you just put in that many characters. The copy paste thing
is just
about.
Do you have to do the copy paste, or is
well,
that
no,
just being efficient?
You could just sit there and
type
100,000 times.
So if you have enough time to type something for 100,000 times, then you can get your way into any phone. Really.
When I was a kid, and I understand and I learned how how numbers worked in English, and I could count up to 1,000 theoretically. I tried to. And it took a really, really long time.
Yeah.
So tapping 150,000 times, that's going to take a really long time. Luckily for people trying this, well, you can just copy and paste, and that's exponents are really nice. But yeah. So
when you're doing that, you're telling people how to break into each other's phones.
That's true. Well, there is a fix that shipped quite a while ago.
Oh, okay.
So that's good.
And Bonnie, do you know why this happened?
Why?
Because software's complicated.
Right. So same topic we were just talking about.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, really, I think most technical issues can be boiled down to that. It's usually not incompetence. Sometimes it's people choosing to not spend, to not put effort to fix a bug that they know about. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, it's just, oops, that we didn't think of that. I guess we'll have to fix that.
Yeah. Well, there's been another glitch outside of the Android universe.
Yeah, since we're talking about Android, we might as well talk about Apple, too.
You know, fairness and all.
Fairness and all. it's cool because Ben's got an Android phone with probably this vulnerability, and I might have software on my phone that had this vulnerability.
Yeah, fun.
So Apple recently, there's this wonderful story about Apple has a press release about malicious code getting in their app store. So one of the things that people argue between Android and Apple all the time. Oh, Ben, you're actually going to test this thing?
Yes, awesome. I'm just testing.
He's
my
about
phone.
To copy and paste a lot on his phone.
we'll get back to him in a future week.
Apple doesn't let stuff.
It doesn't work. I can't copy and paste in the emergency dialer. So woohoo!
Yeah,
I'm protected.
You're safe.
Unless you type, why don't you start typing 100,000 times? Just tap 100,000 times.
Right. How long will that take?
I think they probably fixed that too.
Okay, Apple has stuff on their app store, the iOS app store, the mobile app store. You can download it when you have an Apple device.
Yeah.
That stuff gets up there because developers, like myself, program things, make an app, release it to Apple, asking them to put it on the store. Mm-hmm. Somebody at Apple reviews it. They have software processes. They also have manual processes. And then if it doesn't meet the muster, they kick it back to the developer. So generally, it's a safer environment potentially. Now, that's not necessarily true. But what is true is recently, a security firm told Apple, hey, you've got this vulnerability on a lot of installed applications.
Uh-oh.
They called this a malicious program that was sidecalling into applications. They called it Xcode Ghost.
Wait. You said something interesting. You said that it was malware that was sidecarring into apps. What does that mean?
Yeah, so let's say I make a flashlight app and I submit it to the App Store.
Okay.
And then the security people look at the flashlight app and they're like, oh, there's a flashcode app, but there's also this little piece of code that looks malicious. And they called that thing Xcode Ghost. And they found it a lot of places. A whole bunch of applications all across from different developers had this bit of code.
Okay,
and the
so
reason,
it wasn't necessarily written by the programmers.
Right. In fact, it wasn't written by the programmers.
Oh.
It was written by somebody else that got this to the end of the programmer's code. And so the way that this happened is some malicious person, let's say they call them Bonnie, and they take the Apple Xcode application, which is the software environment you use to develop apps, mm-hmm. from Apple.
Okay.
And they download it on their computer.
Yeah.
Then they modify that application so that anytime you wrote an app for the App Store with that version, mm-hmm. it would also inject this little bit of malicious code.
Well, why would I use your version if I can just use
Apple's? If you
could just
use Apple's. In fact, Apple wants you to use yours.
That's the whole point.
Something other than Apple's is actually difficult to do.
Yeah.
And that's because you happen to be a developer that lives in China. And if you're a developer that lives in China, Apple does not put their software in China on servers local to you. In fact, they keep their software on the outside of the Great Chinese Firewall.
Oh.
You've heard of the China's firewall, right?
Firewall. Yeah.
And basically saying that we don't want to try to supersede what the government's doing, so we let the government filter that content. Unfortunately, that process is quite slow. So if you're a developer in China and you want to develop iOS applications, you want to get that Xcode package, it's really big. It's like 4 gigs, and it would take a long time to download it. So it's very common in China to just download it locally from somebody else's server. And
oh,
this
like,
is like
oh,
a mirror.
My friend Joey has one. I'm just going to go borrow his.
And so because that's a common practice, a lot of developers in China actually don't get the source from the Xcode from Apple. They get it from somewhere else. The version of that on some mirror somewhere had this little virus generating tool, and lots of developers grabbed it, downloaded it, built their apps, submitted it to App Store. Apple didn't catch them, and they got into the wild. Now, by now they're cleared and Apple's fixed the problem. But it's just another example of complexity in software development, right?
I'll say. Wow. And a fairly innocent in a way, right? Because a person could be like, well, I'm going to go borrow Joey's version of this thing that I can't get directly from Apple.
Yeah. And it really does
and
come
Joey
down.
And Joey may not have been like, hey, I've got malware.
Yeah.
He may have gotten it from somebody else and
that's
who
right.
knows.
That's right. In fact, the person that put Xcode up on the server and was hosting it might have just had a vulnerability on their server that someone took advantage of, right? Like the person that was maliciously doing this could be very disassociated from the whole process, mm-hmm. except for they were able to access the system that people were using.
Well, and it strikes me that that's kind of a big vulnerability in Apple's general game plan, which is to really tightly control and make a sort of a closed environment for all of their products so that it is safer.
I would say that if Apple did that perfectly, you know, if Apple really did that perfectly, we wouldn't see problems like this, right? But Apple hasn't done it perfectly. It's very hard to do this kind of thing because the truth is they're general purpose computers and therefore they're extremely hard to control.
Did you hear that phone ring? I think Apple's ears are burning.
Yeah, sorry.
That was definitely an Apple ringtone.
That was an Apple ringtone.
So Apple has removed it from the store and they're removing it from people's machines, these problems. Also, the vulnerability didn't actually do much. It just was a bit of code that showed that it was kind of there. Additionally, The long and the short of this
Wait,
is...
Wait, so was it really malware then? Or
well, it was malware.
Just like
it just didn't get to do very much. Because of the way Apple's structured their system, and actually Android as well, one application doesn't actually have access to other application without interaction by the user.
Okay.
So if I give you a flashlight app, and in my flashlight app it says, find all contacts and email them to me, the first thing that the flashlight's going to have to do is say, hey, Bonnie, you want to share your contacts with this flashlight app?
You're
and you'll
like,
be like, no.
Why?
I don't need to do that.
Yeah.
And so even if it had a vulnerability, it was really restricted to the envelope that it was in. But the big thing that was to note, and to note for me as well, is that any developer that is working on code that goes to one of these stores, the Android stores, the Apple stores, is extremely important to be savvy and protective of your system. Because if your system gets compromised, you could compromise other people's systems. And that's kind of what happened.
Okay. All right. So exhibit good coding hygiene.
Yeah. Although it's hard because just because you're coding doesn't necessarily mean that you have the know-how.
Right.
It could be the exact same situation as why doesn't grandma have antivirus? Right. You know, like just because you're making, you know, an Angry Birds clone to put up on the Android store or something, that doesn't mean that you know enough to protect yourself properly. And that's really ultimately the fundamental problem that we're dealing with over and over again.
Is there something nicer we can talk about?
There's this kind of fun experiment that someone put together.
Okay, what kind of experiment?
Okay, so normally when you go to a website, what happens is your web browser asks some server somewhere for some data and pulls it down.
Mm-hmm. Are you simplifying this, Ben?
I am simplifying it tremendously.
You didn't talk about your keyboard yet.
If you want to know. If you want to know how complex it is, just listen to the entire second portion of the show. This is the third. We're moving on.
Yes.
No, but so where does the data come from? Usually people take this for granted. I go to a website, the webpage is like, hey, pull down some data from, I don't know, Facebook or something like that.
Or geekspeak.org.
Or geekspeak.org, yeah. And so it hits the server, and the server's like, oh, I've got your data for you, and it sends it down, and then your web browser happily takes that data and renders it into the page for you, and then you can interact with, I don't know, your Facebook friends or geekspeak.org in our show today.
So that URL is normally just an address for where the data is.
Well, that's what I've been thinking of it as.
Right. And more specifically, the URL isn't necessarily the only data that you're getting. So when you go to Facebook.com, it loads in kind of a bare bones thing. This is a small white lie, right? They actually do other things, but they load in a basic web page, and then they send off a request for more information. And that more information comes back. Where does that more information come from? It comes from a server. Yeah. Everybody who works in web development knows that.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out it doesn't actually have to. There are a couple other places it can come from. One is it can come from something like local storage or IndexedDB. It's a technology in the browser that holds on to some data for you. So, for example, you could go to benswebsite.com, generate some data, and it could store it in the browser for you. And next time you come back, it pulls it back out.
It's like the cache or something? Like it front loads faster because it's got
information. Yeah, it's holding on to
last
it.
Time. Right.
Exactly.
Okay, gotcha.
Benswebsite.com actually is taken. Thanks, Lyle, for checking that out.
It's available. You can buy it for $10,000.
Oh, no. I don't. Yeah.
Next.
But this person put together this website where you go to the website, and actually, as you read about this thing, this experiment that he did, you come to realize that the text of this page, it says URL hosted as experimental web app that blah, 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 blah. All that information is actually not stored in a server.
Mm-hmm.
It's not stored in local storage or index.b or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually stored in the URL of the...
In the address?
In the address bar. So the address bar is urlhosted.graphicore.de/*#. That's a hash.
Uh-huh.
And then a bunch of stuff. And so usually the hash is used for navigation.
The question mark. You got to have the question mark there. That's important.
It is?
Yeah, that's the query string.
But it's a... Oh, but it's a hash.
The hash is it. Yeah, you're done. Okay.
Yeah, so query parameters would come before.
Sorry, URL
picker. Guys are talking insider baseball.
Right. But anyway, usually what would happen is you go to some website /*/, and then some
gobbledygook stuff. Yeah.
That some stuff is an indicator to the app of where, well, like what page you're on. Are you on Lyle's Twitter page or Ben's Twitter page or whatever? And it's kind of used for that.
Mm-hmm.
This person has taken the hash, and instead of putting information about where in the app you are, they've actually put the data for the website in there.
Now, I imagine that means it's a very long URL.
It is. It is quite long. It's actually not as long as you would think reading all of this text. But here's the really interesting thing.
Yeah.
You could take this URL, this /*/ gobbledygook. You could take that URL. I could send it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could load it up and you would see the information too, because it's coming from the hash. But here's the really fun part. There are these things called URL shorteners.
Oh,
and what
you
do is you take some long URL and you shorten it. One of them is bit.ly. So bit.ly/blah, blah, blah, blah. And it's like 5 characters or something.
Right.
And then I send you this relatively short thing. And then when you click on it, you hit bit.ly servers. Bit.ly is like, oh, I know where that is. It's this longer URL.
Oh, so then Bitly contains the
Bitly is serving your content as the actual URL.
I wonder if that messes with their business model.
It totally doesn't. It's kind of an experiment. Unless someone's thinking of some novel application that I'm not thinking of that's nefarious or something. But it's really fascinating.
How fun.
Yeah.
So it works even with the shortener.
I've used this technology quite a bit because you can actually do data storage with URLs pretty easily.
Yeah.
In fact, taking like a PNG image, you can actually embed it into the URL. So you can share images that you've drawn by just copy-pasting the URL. It's a neat way of
It's called Base64 encoding, and it's basically converting your image into a bunch of gobbledygook text that's really machine-readable, really bad for humans to read.
Well, that was refreshing enough that I feel like, at least for a short visit, I could dive into the deep underbelly of the U.S. government for a little bit more news.
I can do that for you.
Okay.
The DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, recently has a whole discussion about how they've been training their employees to do phishing training, basically to increase security. They have gone to this whole process of training all their employees about protecting themselves from phishing. And the move now is to fire the employee if they can't do a good job on detecting phishing because they have sensitive information. You can read more about that from geekspeak.org.
And you know, we'll follow it up later. I bet there'll be some consequences. That's GeekSpeak for the week. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And you know what follows from that. This is KOSP Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, live online at kosp.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit us at geekspeak.org or email us at geeks@geekspeak.org or contact us on Twitter. We're at kospgeeks. As you may know, our theme song is Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lyle Troxell and Ben Jaffe, along with our intern Chandler, and there's always Greg. Thank you for being here for this September 26th, 2015 episode of GeekSpeak.
By the way, we recommend Avast and Microsoft Security Essentials instead of AVG. I don't know if I'll actually put that in. I might just cut you off.
Yeah, might not because, boy, we were pretty
No, that was perfect. You actually finished perfect timing.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
Right? Good minute, second or two of music.
I was like,
that.
Oh my God.
That really surprised
us. Yeah.
I wish I hadn't done that last story, actually, just in the Avast.
Well, I like that we have it as a thing because you know there's going to be some kind of like HR follow-up on that, you know?
Yeah.
There'll be some kind of like, when this starts at Homeland Security, how else is it applied clumsily at other companies and that kind of thing.
Okay, so we got to do a promo. Oh, wait, keep that off for a second, dude. Sorry, it's really loud.
This week on GeekSpeak, a formerly trustworthy source of protection disappoints. A trio of drones does a lovely dance you can walk on, and even pressing a simple key on your computer can boggle your mind. The geeks explain it all on GeekSpeak, Saturday at 10 a.m. on 88.9 KUSP.